Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone out there, and for those of you on the East Coast, happy Snow Day. We'll have some snow pod-safe music for you later in the program. Also today, our weekly focus segment on legislation happening around the country. This week, we're going to Montana to talk about some possible changes in Montana's medical marijuana bill. That's in our Government at Work weekly segment today. Also today, we'll have Cannabis Science with Dr. Mitch Earlywine and important news today from VoteHemp.com. First, let's get to our news. Our news today was first reported by VoteHemp.com. Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007 introduced in Congress. For the second time since the federal government outlawed hemp farming in the United States, a federal bill has been introduced that would remove restrictions on the cultivation of non-psychoactive industrial hemp. The chief sponsor of H.R. 1009, the Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007, is Representative Ron Paul of Texas. He's joined by 9 Democratic co-sponsors, including Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. VoteHemp.com has the complete text of the bill on their website. Congressman Paul issued this statement to VoteHemp, quote, "It is indefensible that the United States government prevents American farmers from growing this crop. The prohibition subsidizes farmers in countries from Canada to Romania by eliminating American competition and encourages jobs in industries such as food, auto parts, and clothing that utilize industrial hemp to be located overseas instead of the United States," close quote, said Congressman Paul. Dr. Paul continued, quote, "By passing the Industrial Hemp Farming Act, the House of Representatives can help American farmers and reduce the trade deficit, all without spending a single taxpayer dollar," close quote. U.S. companies that manufacture or sell products made with hemp include Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps, a California company who manufactures the number one selling natural soap, and Flexform Technologies, an Indiana company whose natural fiber materials are used in over 2 million cars. Hemp food manufacturers such as French Meadow Bakery and Living Harvest and Nature's Path now make their products from Canadian hemp. Although hemp grows wild across the United States, a vestige of centuries of hemp farming, the hemp for these products must be imported. Health Canada statistics show that 48,060 acres of industrial hemp were produced in Canada in 2006. Farmers in Canada have reported that hemp is one of the most profitable crops that they can grow. Hemp clothing is made around the world by well-known brands such as Patagonia and Giorgio Armani. There is strong support among key national organizations for a change in the federal government's position on hemp. The National Association of State Departments of Agriculture, or NASDA, quote, supports revisions to the federal rules and regulations authorizing commercial production of industrial hemp, close quote. The National Conference of State Legislatures, or NCSL, has also passed a pro-hemp resolution. Numerous individual states have expressed interest in industrial hemp as well. 15 states have passed pro-hemp legislation, and 7 have removed barriers to its production or research. North Dakota has issued state licenses, the first in 50 years, to 2 farmers so far. Representative Paul's bill would remove federal barriers and allow laws in these states regulating the growing and processing of industrial hemp to take effect. Eric Stenstra, president of Vote Hemp, offered these comments on the bill. Quote, under the current national drug control policy, industrial hemp can be imported, but it can't be grown by American farmers. Close quote. He continued, quote, the DEA has taken the Controlled Substances Act's antiquated definition of marijuana out of context and used it as an excuse to ban industrial hemp farming. The Industrial Hemp Farming Act of 2007 will bring us back to more rational times when the government regulated marijuana but told farmers they could go ahead and continue raising hemp just as they always had. Close quote. More information on the bill is available at VoteHemp.com. And if you're on the East Coast today, you're digging out. Here's a group called Spaghetti Cake with this song, Snow Day.
Look out the window and what do you find? A smooth white carpet, the night snow left behind. Run up the stairwell to see if it is real. Flick on the radio, hey DJ, what's the deal? It might be a snow day. Please let it be a snow day. School after school canceled because of ice and snow. The roads are slick and the buses should not go. Grab your galoshes, your waterproof boots, your snow pants, your mittens, your snowboard to boot. It's gonna be a snow day. Yeah, there's no way we'll make it to school today.
Snow day, racing, boogie, yeah, it's a snow day.
snow days for podcasters out there. That was Spaghetti Cake with Snow Day here on Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Now it's time for our weekly segment, Government at Work. On the Audio Stash, we're highlighting different local legislative efforts regarding marijuana happening around the country this winter. Montana is considering changes to the medical marijuana program that might allow patients easier access to cannabis medication there. Currently, the rules there only permit one usable ounce of marijuana to be possessed by patients. That low amount, combined with rural distances, leave many Montana patients at risk of breaking the law simply to keep an adequate supply of their medicine on hand. Joining us today to discuss the proposed legislation is Tom Dobear from Dobear Associates in Montana. Tom, welcome to the Audio Stash today.
Thanks very much.
Tom, thanks again for taking time to join us here today to highlight these efforts. First, tell us about the medical marijuana bill moving through the legislature there in Montana.
Well, the only bill specific to marijuana, unfortunately at the moment, isn't really moving, but it's House Bill 311, which seeks to fine-tune Montana's compassionate medical marijuana law to make it work better for patients so they can get the medicine they need when they need it and not have to fear arrest in prison, which is the policy Montana voters overwhelmingly endorsed.
And how specifically, Tom, would HB 311 change the program rules there for medical marijuana?
Well, 311 proposes three fundamental changes. One is currently only physicians can make recommendations to patients that allow them to register with the health department for the program. House Bill 311 would add nurse practitioners and physician assistants, giving them the same authority as regards medical marijuana as they already offer patients with respect to opium, opiates and other pharmaceuticals. And this is critically important to patients, especially in rural areas, which if you look at a map you'll find is most of Montana. There are an awful lot of patients who are served regularly by nurse practitioners and physician assistants. They don't deal with doctors. The doctors are hundreds of miles away. A second provision in House Bill 311 would create a new category of registrant that we call transporter. It would, if a registered patient has a caregiver, then that patient could also designate one person to be a transporter who would then legally be able to pick up the medicine from the caregiver and bring it home to the bedside of the patient. Right now we've got elderly parents of patients, people in their 80s and older, driving hundreds of miles to pick up marijuana that's legal when they pick it up and legal when they get to the patient's bedside, but they're technically breaking the law during the drive home, and we don't think that's fair for them, and that's one of the provisions of the bill. The third, perhaps most controversial provision would change the limits on allowable quantities. Right now, a registered patient can have six plants, and the bill would specify that that limit of six plants only applies to mature plants that are actually producing medicine. Anyone who's grown marijuana can tell you that it's not as easy as people think, especially if you're already sick. And patients, if they want to be sure of following the law and not running out of medicine, they need the latitude to have more plants and to have more than 1 ounce of actual marijuana at a time. As you probably know, under the federal government's own medical marijuana program, they distribute about 6 pounds per year per patient in their program. That means that Montana's current 1 ounce limit really only covers you for about 3.5 days, which is, again, not enough for patients who can't afford to run out of the medicine they need because of the pain they experience and other conditions without the medical marijuana.
And can you tell us more, Tom, why this legislation is hung up right now in committee?
Yes, the House Judiciary Committee voted 10-7 to table the bill. And right now we're working to see if we can change a couple of those votes with the strategy of proposing to amend the bill actually to leave only the nurse practitioner and physician assistants portion of the bill. It's very difficult to change some of the minds on this committee, though. The no votes tend to be folks who, despite Montana voters' overwhelming support for the policy, just are refusing so far to vote in any way that endorses the concept of medical marijuana.
Tom, I want to thank you again for taking time to highlight this Montana legislation today, and I hope to speak with you again here on the audio stat.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tom Dobear is with Dobear Associates in Montana. Montana residents can help take action by urging their legislators to get this bill out of committee. We have links to take action at normalaudiostash.com. That was our weekly Government at Work segment focusing on different local state legislatures and their work towards marijuana reform. Next up today, it's time to check in with the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Wednesdays here on the Audio Stash, we get the chance to discuss the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. Mitch is also the editor of the new book Pot Politics, and we have links to the books at normalaudiostash.com. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Wonderful to have you back on the show this week, Mitch. And we're going to discuss a new paper you co-authored with Allison Luby and Dale Geringer. The article is entitled Roadside Sobriety Tests and Attitudes Towards a Regulated Cannabis Market. This was a pretty big telephone survey, Mitch. First, tell us how the survey came about.
Oh, there was a big opportunity that actually Alan St. Pierre informed me about, that we could get a Zogby poll of over 1,000 registered voters and get their opinions on having a taxed and regulated cannabis market. And we had a neat idea that basically we would ask folks, would they support such a market, and would they support such a market if they knew there was a good roadside sobriety test to determine if someone was driving soon after smoking cannabis.
So basically here the public in the survey is saying if there were like a breathalyzer test for cannabis like there is for alcohol, there would be stronger support for a legalized, regulated marketplace for marijuana overall.
Well, in fact, we were looking for more of a behavioral kind of measure because the breathalyzer technology for cannabis just isn't out there. And what's funny is we asked folks, you know, would you support this if there were such a thing? In fact, there is such a thing. There's a wonderful set of roadside sobriety tasks, much like the ones that law enforcement officers already use for alcohol, that is very sensitive to cannabis, and I'm happy to say sensitive to all kinds of impairment like things from antihistamines and things along those lines. And I'd love to see people move towards these roadside sobriety tests instead of things that are based on blood metabolites or urine screens, because those are going to be way down the line as far as cannabis intoxication is concerned. You could test positive on those and not be impaired at all. And I'm hoping that a paper like this could encourage people to ask their law enforcement folks to lean much more on behavioral measures.
And because this is not some technology-based system for detecting intoxication, this is something that won't cost a whole lot of money to implement in individual communities.
Oh, it's incredibly comparable to the ones already used for alcohol. It's simple tasks like walking a straight line and using a certain number of steps, following the officer's finger with your eyes, things along those kinds of tasks. And, you know, they're literally just a little bit of law enforcement time to increase the training to include some of these indices that are more sensitive to cannabis and other forms of impairment.
And Mitch, something I found interesting in reading the article is that there were subsets of folks based on political affiliation that sort of trended one way or the other with the tax and regulate market.
As it turns out, you know, anytime you're doing a phone interview about people's voting behavior on something this controversial, you might guess that these are mild underestimates. But the folks who you would think would support it were definitely the ones who would support it. So folks who were Democrat or Libertarian tended to be more likely to support the market. Men more than women, which is a surprise to some folks, but I think the movement needs to reach out to women and make it clear to them that folks who want to do so responsibly, and women were, you know, spearheading the movement to get rid of alcohol prohibition in part because of their, you know, care for their own children and family members, and I think as we get more and more women involved in the movement, it'll be much more helpful. Even with the reliable roadside sobriety test, we only had 44% of the sample agree to the idea of a tax and regulated market. So we're still short of a majority, but that was up from 36%. And once we got to that 44%, the differences related to gender and ethnicity and political party were no longer really as big.
Now, Mitch, we hear about 1,000 voter polls all the time in politics and the media. Are these really a good indicator of public attitudes?
Well, and in fact, to try to generalize to the whole nation from 1,000 people may be a little much. But generally, these are part of a whole set of questions. I believe there are about 50 questions in this particular poll. And so this is buried in between a whole bunch of other questions. I don't think the demand is particularly high. And we've seen on other, you know, voter-related stuff at the federal level, these tend to be fairly accurate predictors of national behavior. If we wanted to focus on an individual state, in fact, 1,000 people is a very good way of guessing how a state initiative might go over. And we may do that in the future as individual states start considering legislation like this.
And finding 40% in favor of a tax and regulate market for marijuana, that's almost in line with how many folks in America have self-reported using marijuana once in their lifetime.
In fact, it's just a little bit higher, and I'm eager to see that and wonder if perhaps our estimates of the number of people who have used are underestimates, because so many people are willing to support a tax and regulated market as long as these roadside sobriety tests are available.
And when you call folks out of the blue, Mitch, and ask them about a regulated marijuana market in the United States, what pops into their head? What is the average perception of that idea?
We try to word the question so it would be parallel to alcohol. So it wouldn't be like cannabis is available at the 7-Eleven for children to buy. It would be folks who are over 21 who can prove so, and who could, do this in a store much like the way we have established liquor stores in some states. And I feel like people are open to that idea and understand that the negative consequences of cannabis are really limited. Anthony Liguori did a wonderful job in Pot Politics of reviewing this literature on driving, and in truth, cannabis-related impairments in driving aren't particularly well documented, seem markedly less severe than those associated with alcohol, even at 0.05 and other, you know, levels that are considered below the threshold for driving under the influence. And I think people understand that this wouldn't be a big issue at all, particularly if there was public awareness about the roadside sobriety test.
And just to be clear here, Mitch, there's no data out there yet that says anyone is really at a hugely increased risk for a car accident with marijuana intoxication. Is that correct?
Well, and the thing that we don't hear about a lot is some of the early work on cannabis and car crashes showed slightly smaller risk in cannabis users of being responsible for a crash, and it just ended up being an interesting idea that nobody really entertained. But I think most folks who are cannabis users don't want to drive during intoxication, and they definitely want to stay in and enjoy themselves and have a good time rather than end up going anywhere else.
And also, Mitch, just to be clear on this issue as well, that the current field sobriety test is not effective in detecting marijuana intoxication. Is that right as well?
There's just a really mild modification. It has to do with how you do the eye tracking test with your finger in front of the person's eyes and how they jerk their head when they do that. And it's kind of curious, but basically people who are have recently smoked cannabis tend to have a harder time actually holding their head still during that eye tracking. And then some of the same impairments that you see with short-term memory during intoxication, if you say take 9 steps forward along this line, unfortunately people who are very high on cannabis don't count to 9 very well. And so, of course, that would be an obvious sign of impairment if they took 11 steps or only 8 or something like that.
Mitch, this is amazing and somewhat funny to me as well. I mean, when folks are stoned, they can't count to 9. It almost sounds like an urban legend of sorts.
I'm reluctant to you know, let all this out because I want to make sure the test remains accurate, but that's essentially a key component of one of the errors that people make during alcohol intoxication as well, is that this is how they mess up the test. It's not that they can't walk a straight line. It's that they can't count 9 steps.
Well, Mitch, we appreciate your honesty and information here today. I promise not to try and get the rest of the sobriety test details out of you, at least today. Mitch, it really is wonderful to have you on the program each week, and I thank you for taking time to speak with us on the Audio Stash today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be here, Chris.
And thanks again, Mitch. You can read Mitch's new article, co-authored with Allison Luby and Dale Gerringer, who's the California Normal Coordinator. The article is entitled Roadside Sobriety Tests and Attitudes Towards a Regulated Cannabis Market. We have links to the article on our website today at normalaudiostash.com. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at State University of New York and author of the book Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. His newest book, and he's the editor, is Pot Politics. We have links to the books as well at normalaudiostash.com.
Thank you.
That's a group called Sunburn in Cyprus with that track Change. They were found up at podshow.com. We have links to them and all the artists you heard on the program today on our website at normalaudiostash.com. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.